Welcome to the Criterion Chat, a podcast on cinema in the Criterion Collection. I'm Matt Peterson, joined by Nate Myers. Tonight, Alain René's Hiroshima Mon Amour, released in 1959. Written by Marguerite Duras, the film was an achingly romantic yet tragic meditation on illicit love, set against the existential threat of past and future nuclear annihilation. Nonlinear editing and the film's authentic post-war setting create a dreamlike quality, with limbs of lovers juxtaposed with those of the A-bomb's victims. A product of the left bank of French New Wave cinema, the film aims to create a new language that does not depend on films that came before, fusing documentary elements with impressionistic storytelling. The film was released by Criterion on Blu-ray in 2015, sourced from a 2013 restoration. Join Nate and me as we discuss the yield of René's influential picture. Well, Nate, nuclear bomb gallows humor aside, if anyone caught that at the end, I guess. here we are. So Hiroshima Mon Amour, you know, this is a film that it's been quite a long time since I watched this, and I was kind of anxious to revisit it for several reasons. It's a film that I remember fondly and remember it kind of having an influence on, you know, some of the short films and things that I did back in the day. And so I was curious to see, you know, how it's sort of aged, given my experience since then. But I also thought, you know, we're kind of living in an era here of increased awareness when it comes to the potential for nuclear conflict. And it's something that we haven't really faced, I would argue, since, you know, the Cuban Missile Crisis. And a lot of people, some people seem to be taking that seriously. A lot of people don't really seem to think it's a thing or it's a real risk or a real threat. And it obviously is. So I thought, not to make this a political discussion by any means, but I thought it would just be an appropriate time to revisit this film. And also in the light of Christopher Nolan's Oppenheimer. And one of the criticisms leveled against that film was just the fact that it didn't really depict what happened to the Japanese on screen. And this film definitely doesn't shy away from the reality of nuclear conflict and the effects of the atom bomb. So a lot to unpack here, a lot of directions we could take this. I guess I'll kind of zoom out, though, first, as we usually do, and just talk about the French New Wave a little bit. So this is really a cornerstone film within that movement. Is the French New Wave something that was good or bad for cinema? Nate?
I don't think it's that simple.
Yeah, no. go any way you want with that. Yeah, just French New Wave in general, just thoughts on it.
Well, there's obviously wonderful things that came from it, and there's also terrible things that came from it. Not necessarily the French New Wave itself, but just, I mean, there's a lot of stupid decisions people made in movies trying to imitate or emulate what was happening with people like Godard or Truffaut or René, you know. So it's one of those things where you can point to things and go like, yep, that kind of was regrettable. But I think you can't really necessarily always attribute that to the French New Wave itself. Because you can't always hold a teacher, shall we say, responsible for his student. And so I think that there certainly is plenty of people who mimic the New Wave or got carried away with some of its intentions or what it did. And ultimately, you know, maybe made the cinema kind of trite in some respects. But overall, I think it's a net positive, and its influences are primarily a good thing in the history of 20th century cinema. And I think this film, it's actually kind of one of those things where you do debate a little bit. These late 1950s, early 1960s films, you know, what is or is not technically the French New Wave, and how did the people themselves understand? René, you know, as much as he's talked about and as much as I think it's accurate to say that he was looking or creating a new language to cinema or trying to do things that had never been done before, or at the very least trying to mainstream things that had only been maybe experimental and off the beaten path before. He always thought of himself as being a guy who was completely in continuity with what had come before him too. So, you know, you got all these weird little nuances you got to sift through, and you made reference in your opening remarks there to the left bank of cinema. That's going to be obviously even a deeper cut than the French New Wave, since there was this idea of two different schools within the French New Wave, right? This left bank, which would have people like Agnès Varda or Alain René, who would have been considered to be much more, let's be bold, let's not be patient with, you know, how we're trying to depict things and the ways we're trying to really push the boundaries of cinema, compared to certain other elements of the French New Wave, such as maybe what would be represented by François Truffaut, who, while still politically liberal, were maybe more conventional in how they created characters and stories and arcs and things like that, right? So it's such a wildly complex phenomenon once you really get into it. But overall, I think that this film could be called one of the first elements of the French New Wave. I mean, there's, you know, debate about what really was the first film. And in some ways, I think the thought is Louis Malle paved the way with Elevator to the Gallows, which technically isn't considered New Wave, but boy, it did seem to do everything that allowed the New Wave to exist. So, you know, it's really an early example of the New Wave, right along, I think, 400 Blows is the same year, mm-hmm. and Breathless was just a year after this, right? So it's certainly, I think, a film that holds up as showing the height of what was happening with New Wave in terms of really trying to push narrative, and or not even say push narrative, but push atmosphere as the means of narrative. I was thinking about this film in the particular about, if I were to give you a plot summary of it, it wouldn't really necessarily give you the sense of what the movie is about. You know, so I could say, like, for example, I don't know, something like a French woman and a Japanese man have a love affair while she is in Hiroshima filming an anti-war film. And she begins reflecting upon her past experience during World War II with a German soldier. And, you know, it could even describe a scene, you know. And I don't know that the verbal description, even though it might be accurate to what actually happens, can convey what's actually in the scenes themselves. Because it's so caught up in just the visual images or the way in which he edits between one thing or another. You know, the famous match shot or match edit that we have between the hugging of the mother and her daughter, and then the two lovers, right? So there's all sorts of things here that I think you have to just kind of experience to really understand this film, which is a big part of what I think the New Wave was trying to do. Instead of making film really just kind of a visual novel, right, trying to make it its own visceral experience.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to characterize it. You know, when I think of the French New Wave, I agree with you in terms of the difficulty in really characterizing the movement, right? I mean, it does seem to be sort of this smear of continuity in many ways. And when I think of that movement, I think of it fondly because there's a lot of films that came out of it and a lot of, you know, cinematic language that came out of it that I actually find very effective and enjoy. But at the same time, I feel like it was such an era of egos, you know, these directors, yeah, just throwing their names around and this is real cinema and this is real cinema. And you know, Truffaut and his group were, you know, really coming out of film criticism, right? And this idea of, okay, well, we've just been steeped in the history and lore of cinema and now we're in a position to go out and make our own films. Whereas, yeah, someone like René is, you know, coming at it from a different perspective, you know, more, you could say more literary perspective or just a perspective that was uninterested in prior cinematic language and more interested in either documentaries or, you know, someone like Agnès Varda you mentioned as well. And we can see that influence very clearly here, right? So Night and Fog is another documentary work by René on the Holocaust that really kind of showed his interest in documentary filmmaking. And this film starts as a documentary, really, juxtaposed with very lyrical voiceover, right? Almost poetic voiceover. And it gets a little laborious in the beginning. You're like, all right, we got it. You know, let's wrap
it
up.
And he would only continue that more as his career went on, by the way. I don't know if you've seen last year at Mönchengladbach, but this is obviously a trial run for what he will do with that just a few years later.
It's like, yeah, there's not a lot of subtlety here, you know, when it comes to some of these stylistic choices. And you really have to just go along with it. And, you know, the first 15 minutes of this film, you're either on board or you're not, right? And you can see how, okay, we're really taking advantage of the post-war setting, the fact that, you know, we're shooting in these real locations. They're literally shooting in an A-bomb museum, right? And we're seeing historical footage intercut with these museum displays. And at first, you're not quite sure what to make of this. And you know, we're getting slammed with these full-screen intercut images of bodies and limbs, and eventually it's revealed that, you know, these are the two lovers that are embracing, and that's probably the most famous and striking image from this film. But that non-linear, you know, lyrical style, I think is very effective in this film, and it really strengthens as the film progresses. If you can get through that initial sequence and really stick with it and go along with the experience, I think as a viewer, you'll be rewarded. But you know, this film, I think, really does have a lot to say about morality, right? So morality of relationships and the morality of war. And you know, I use the word juxtaposition a lot here because that's really what this film is. I mean, it's pairing elements that you wouldn't necessarily consider pairing, right? And these are some very disturbing, startling images that we're seeing, some very heavy themes that we're trying to explore. Of course, this is taking place during the aftermath of World War II, but clearly the Cold War looms large over this film, right? And there's still this existential threat of nuclear conflict, nuclear annihilation that everyone is very aware of. Now, it's not in the context of U.S. versus Japan anymore. It's very different. So it's interesting that such an intimate relationship is paired with something that's so global. So it's these two extremes that are constantly kind of shoved against one another. And you wouldn't think that it would work. And maybe it doesn't for some people, but it's an interesting pairing. Just curious your impressions as to how effective the film is as a whole in terms of bringing these seemingly disparate elements together.
What strikes me is it's a bit obvious, but am I thinking of that because I'm not watching it in 1959?
Potentially, yeah.
We've seen a lot of this kind of stuff where let's do this very intimate thing with the backdrop of a major event. And that's not even unique to Hiroshima Mon Amour. I mean, you know, Dickens with A Tale of Two Cities or something, you know, doing similar, you know, it's the idea of an epic, but this is obviously much more avant-garde, you know, if you want to use a phrase, because it's really trying to make claims. It could be, I think, accurately called pretentious, to be honest with you.
It's fair.
Particularly with the voiceover. I was thinking, watching this again, like, this is definitely, I know it's, I think, technically a French-Japanese co-production because money came from both worlds, but this is definitely a French film. Only a Frenchman makes a movie of this where you have this waxing poetic philosophical voiceover narration and your disparate images being thrown and connected with it, right? It's very, very French. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, but I could see how it could be off-putting to a person. Mm-hmm. And I do think that there are elements of the film that are less successful than others in the sense that I think two problems that it has that, you know, I don't know if I picked up on these the first time I saw it, but definitely watching it again for this conversation, it was apparent to me. The first is that it really is not able, I think, to successfully take this unnamed Japanese architect that we don't really know anything about and really give us any sense of him and the bombing and what it meant to him, to his family, to his world. I don't think it even is attempting it, which I think is a mistake, because it's so caught up on her and what happened to her back in France and Nevers, where she is in this love affair. Her German officer dies, and then she is discovered to have had this affair and ostracized and, you know, put in the cellar with her by her parents, and she's got her head shaved, all these different things that take place, right? Which were, of course, very real occurrences in the war, or following the war, more accurately. But it spends so much time with her that it almost seems to not give any voice to the Japanese. And I think the film is not intentionally trying to do that. I think it has this idea that by focusing in on her, that somehow this will transcend and relate and explain something about them, and it makes all these connections that I don't think it ever actually does. But I'm open to being told I'm wrong, because I'm sure other people would say, no, it does succeed in that goal. The other thing I think it doesn't really quite succeed in is the shift it makes from being basically documentary into abstract. You know, the first images are really quite striking. You know, the two images that we have of the lovers, you know, covered in dust, as if, you know, the ashes of, you know, the nuclear war. Nuclear
fallout,
and, yeah, and then, you know, slowly kind of molding in just to the sweaty embrace and the closeness, and that kind of imagery is so powerful. And then it goes into this stark depiction of Hiroshima with the destruction. And then it goes back into some surreal imagery again. And then it goes into this interesting editing. And I don't know that it actually succeeds in blending all the elements together. I think they're all effective, but I don't know that they actually coalesce. And that's probably because this is René's first feature-length film. And I don't know that he necessarily had perfectly captured everything. He's very into the form, but I don't know that he actually had a lot to say or how to manage the channel, the form towards something significant. Hmm.
Yeah, it's interesting you bring up the lack of focus on the Japanese or the architect story in particular. I think that's more a product of, well, this is primarily a film for French audiences, even though it's a co-production. It's, you know, a French audience could relate more to the French story within the film or the French character. So it's probably as simple as that. You know, could the film benefit from more of an exploration of his character? Yeah, certainly. I mean, you do have that brief moment where he mentions that he was not, I mean, obviously he wasn't in the city when it occurred, but his family was, but it's brushed away very quickly, right? And we know, we don't really learn the details, and we don't get the sense that he doesn't want to talk about it. It's just not really addressed. And yeah, I guess I would agree it's a missed opportunity. At the same time, you do have to be selective about what you're focusing on. And clearly, she doesn't even have a name in this film, right?
Yep.
Emmanuel Riva's character is the primary focus here. And, you know, it's a story that probably was all too common within France. A young French woman having a relationship with a German soldier. And as you said, you know, these are things that occurred. And this is something that has clearly been very, very traumatic for her character and has essentially ruined her relationships to some extent going forward. And I think the setting of this film is meant to be the catalyst for her to move on from that, right? And that's kind of what we see toward the end of the movie. But there's a line that really stuck out to me this time from the architect, just him stating that, you know, when the bomb was dropped, the whole world rejoiced, you know, and then even you rejoiced, addressing Emmanuel Riva's character. And that really hit in a pretty deep way. It's it just kind of speaks to the complexity of war, right? The tragedy of it, the fact that, yeah, you do celebrate when it's ending, but at the same time, you know, an ending typically coincides with great loss of life in some capacity. And her own experience, her own loss of her German lover, in a way was like an explosion within her own life, right? The whole world was rejoicing when World War II ended in Europe, when her town was liberated, but her world was destroyed. So it's, I think that's where their two experiences meet, and where the setting of Hiroshima and her own background cross over in a very interesting way. And it's a way that isn't necessarily immediately evident, but I think there's a thematic connection there that works pretty well. But yeah, would that have been more effective if they had developed the architect's character and backstory a bit more? Sure. But he just seems way too interested in just jumping into bed again versus discussing his family trauma.
I think that's somewhat fair, that that's certainly their goal in terms of what they're trying to do. And they're not completely unsuccessful, right? I don't think Renee and Marguerite Duras in her screenplay are unsuccessful in making that connection that the intimate and the, or shall I say, the micro and the macro meet. I think that that is part of what they're trying to note here. The individual story is where you can really get a sense of the weight of something, whereas something as big as Hiroshima, and, you know, the first part is I saw, you know, you never saw Hiroshima. I saw it. I saw this. I saw this. I saw this. And the, going through the museum, right?
Yeah.
And seeing some of those images is still not really seeing it, right? And so I think, you know, when you can start getting all these big, massive stats about the bomb or about the attack, about the death tolls, about the blast force and all that stuff, right? You can understand something of the facts, but do you really understand the human element from all that, right? Whereas I think the film's trying to show, well, look at this and look at that there is a kind of universality in this story too, right? What happened in Hiroshima is not just unique to Hiroshima. It's something that's happened throughout history. Mm-hmm. I'm curious, though. It sounded like you took a little different interpretation at the end with her character, right? So I think Emmanuel Riva's character, the woman, of course, at the end, they give each other names. You know, we don't know their names, and they don't have actually a real name, but
yeah.
She gives him the name of Hiroshima. He gives her the name of Nevers, which is the city where she'd grown up and said she never would go back to. But then, of course, she seems to indicate she would at the end, and there seems to be a catharsis of sorts. But I think that last scene shows that she really never has, and I think part of the film's point is you never can truly let go or forget, as much as like forgetting is supposed to be a part of how you move forward. Mm-hmm. I think the film's theme, and I think this is actually a part that's really successful and really brilliant about it, is that these events shape and mold us in ways we may not always talk about, we may not always recognize, but are who we are. And even the names they give each other at the end are hitting that point, right? For whatever happens going forward for both of their lives, and all that's happened in the interim between when the war ended and now, because, you know, we've learned that she's married, presumably he's married, but even her talking about, you know, I got married, I have kids, all these different things, and they're kind of learning these little details about each other. You know, at the end of the day, what's the formative event for each of them? The town they came from, right? Mm-hmm. Their history, and that can never be gone. And that, in a certain sense, I don't think she ever will let go of that German soldier, that first love that she had. And whatever this affair is now will also be grafted onto the history of her story and onto his story, right? So I think that's what it's showing, not so much that there's any breakthrough. I mean, there's maybe almost her trying to psych herself into a breakthrough. But I think the film looks at it as saying, no, there really isn't one.
I would agree with you there. I didn't mean to say earlier that I felt like she was actually getting over it. It's like she was trying to talk herself into it, right? And trying to bury the pain or move on in some way. But I don't feel like she was successful. And I also feel like her maturity and just her emotional state is stunted, you know, because of that experience. I mean, first love, generally speaking, is not a deep and lasting relationship. I mean, let's face it, right? You know, this is typically an infatuation, right? It's typically something that is quite juvenile. There's no maturity to it. It's a very exciting experience, but you don't know what the hell you're doing, generally speaking. So for her to be so caught up in that idea, I think still speaks to a lack of maturity that's probably still, you know, persisting within her. Hard to say for sure, but here she is again in sort of this whirlwind romance, probably very much an infatuation, right? It's like they just met less than 24 hours ago. I mean, to say that this is a deep, meaningful, lasting connection, I think would be an overstatement. And they even seem to be aware of the superficiality and kind of the transient nature of their relationship and are almost embracing it in many ways, that she seems to know that, well, she's had other affairs, she'll have other ones in the future, and this will probably fade from her memory in time. And I think the film wants us to think that they have a deeper connection as the film continues, and maybe they do, but you still get the sense that these are ships passing in the night, you know, and both of them are committed, and they both claim to be happily married, which I thought was an interesting detail as well. And they,
you know, it's just European sensibilities, right?
I don't know.
He speaks French. He must have learned it somewhere.
Well, this brings me back to just kind of the question of, you know, morality of relationships. You know, what is this film being critical of this kind of casual relationship in any way? Or is it just accepting it outright? I mean, it doesn't seem to be critical.
No, I don't think it is.
You know, but it's interesting because, you know, Emmanuel Riva's character admits to having, I think she puts it as loose morals, or she seems to have this sense of awareness that she doesn't make great
decisions.
Doesn't she
say questionable morals? I thought, I could be remembering it wrong, but I thought of it because it struck me that she was, that the point of that scene, and I know it's all in French, it's not actually in English, yeah, you know, in the dialogue, but
yeah,
I always took that to be, you know, that there's an element of questioning the moral order around you, because, I mean, look at what they are. They're in the shell of a bombed city that was nuclearly attacked. And what did all those moral codes get this world? Mm-hmm. I think that, I thought that was kind of the idea of what she was going for there. And that's why there's kind of this nonchalant, at least on the part of the characters. I think the film's just documenting. I don't think it's judging one way or the other.
Mm.
But for the character, at least her character, saying, what's the point of having it? I mean, I had an affair with a German officer, and this was deemed worthy of, you know, putting me in a cellar,
mm-hmm,
and where, mm-hmm, I clawed myself and fed on my own blood, right?
Yeah,
I'm not saying that's like a correct, you know, thing in the abstract. I'm just saying I think that's her take on it.
Okay. Well, fair enough. I mean, I just think that the film just seems a bit lacking in that regard, you know. And not that I want the film to necessarily pass judgment, but it's hard for me to feel terribly sympathetic toward this couple. In a situation like this, it seems like the film is wanting the audience, you know, for them to live happily ever after, or to have this lasting connection, and is sort of trying to sell me on the validity of this relationship. But to me, this is just a film that's kind of drenched with tragedy on so many levels, right? It's like, obviously you have the tragedy of Hiroshima bombing and the tragedy of this couple. It's like they have seemingly good marriages. They have past trauma that they just have not been able to reconcile, and it just continues to wreak havoc with them spiritually, you know, personally, interpersonally. So there's a real sort of curtain of sadness that I experience when watching this, And again, it's not like a judgmental thing. It's just, it's more a sense that, well, I hope these two people are able to find some inner peace because they don't seem to have it even in each other's arms. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, it's maybe worth noting that the Japanese title of the film is 24-Hour Love Affair.
Hmm.
I don't know how that was picked or not, you know, and whether Renee or others would have had any say in that. But I think that also hits at, I think that's a very good title. In many ways, that's actually, to me, a better title than Hiroshima Mon Amour, because I think that it does get at the fleeting nature of this relationship.
Yeah.
And that I don't know that the film is got a sense of a rooting interest in their love story, or that it's trying to get me to root for them. I never at least watch this and say to myself, boy, I really hope the two of them make it. It's actually, you know, it's, I'm sure it had to be just something Renee was relishing, the opportunity to have the final nightclub that they meet up again at, where the other guy's hitting on her, is Casablanca.
Yeah.
Right. You know, I mean, just that to me is a romantic love story, right? Where you really would love Rick and Ilsa to be able to get together.
Sure.
But the forces of the war, the higher purpose, and how noble that he lets go of the woman he loves. And, you know, she goes off with her husband, all the, right? But boy, you kind of do wish that the husband could be out of the way and the two of them could make it work, right? And so I see that as like, this is like the anti-Casablanca in a sense, because it's not really having any sentimentality towards this story. And of course, because it doesn't have any sentimentality, then it doesn't have a condemnation of it either, right? It isn't interested in trying to evaluate the morality of their actions or look at them from that perspective. I think it's really just meditating on the nature of a very broken world and how it has hit these particular characters. Now, that could be also, I think, legitimately looked at from a film criticism perspective as saying, well, so what? I mean, bad things happen. We know this. Do you have anything more to say about it? And I think where it might have something worth saying, again, I think it misses a little bit on the fact that it doesn't really give the resonance that we need from the Japanese perspective, which could have happened without diminishing by any sense Emmanuel Riva's character's story. Actually, the greater emphasis on that might have also actually helped draw greater attention to her, right, and to what she's going through, and help stress the parallel. But what I do think it does well is it does capture the trauma that just lingers in your life. And, you know, I don't know, I mean, certainly there's an immaturity to her, like you said, about how she's just going from bed to bed and hopping from relation to relationship. But at the same time, it strikes me as perfectly understandable. It's not something I would have a hard time rationalizing, you know, as you're trying to make sense of it, right? I mean, so it's also not a perfect, it's not like an illogical response to what we've seen or learned about her character, how she's choosing to live now.
Yeah, like I was saying, I think she's in a way forever trapped in the mindset of that first relationship, you know. And it's not only the pain of losing that relationship, it's what occurred after, you know, that made it that much more difficult for her. Were you going to say something?
Well, I was wondering if it's specifically the fact that she has to see him die, and that she has to be there, and she can't have the lover's death. It's Romeo and Juliet, but only if Romeo dies, right? I wonder if that's the great thing, like, you know, the love affair meant is supposed to be that, you know, you die together and therefore you live in eternity. And she's like, no, I lost the love of my life. However naive that might've been, however ill-fated that relationship might've been, she doesn't see it. She can't see that. But then she deals with the trauma of that, has to deal with seeing him die, be with him when he dies. You know, the twitch of his hand, and then seeing the twitch again with the Japanese architect as he's sleeping, right? So it's obviously going to resonate with her the rest of her life. But then she goes also into, and I can't even celebrate the end of a war. I can't celebrate anything. As a matter of fact, the horror of the war just continues on for me. So I think you're right that the stuff that falls after, but I think it's the fact that he dies, not just like he gets deployed back home. I think that's the key critical thing for her, because that they seem to make a point visually throughout the film and in its editing to hit that moment regularly.
Yeah, and she, the pain of that is amplified by the fact that she points out that she wasn't even aware of the moment that he actually died, which I think is an interesting detail. You know, it's not like you have that perfect sort of death scene moment where gives the last breath and then slumps over. It's like, I even missed the moment that he left. And then,
right.
And then she mentions the detail of like spending all day with his body. Essentially, she was just like laying there. So pretty heavy stuff. I mean, I kind of appreciate how the film didn't go super melodramatic with that, either showing that on screen. But the tragedy of it is enhanced by those little details and how she tells that story. And that whole scene where she's just drinking like Sapporo beer endlessly, recounting her time in the cellar, is also pretty effective, I think. And this architect must not be very well known, because he's just like out in public cradling her face, you know, without his wife or whatever. But that's a small aside. It's still a very effective piece of filmmaking, I think. You know, the cutaways, the nonlinear editing, some of the shots here are very, very striking. I mean, we should talk about some of the technical aspects of this too. And I think the cinematography is beautiful in this film, on the most part, and some really gorgeous, just long lens shots in particular. That beautiful composition, just some of those singular shots that we just cut to and then cut back to the scene are so effective. And the score is really effective too, along with them. Any thoughts just on the editing or the visuals in this film?
Well, before I go to that, I just want to circle back on that one little detail about how she wasn't even there for the death scene,
sure,
so to speak. I think that's also, if you're trying to explain to someone why the French New Wave, or what the French New Wave brought to cinema, it was things like that, details like that. Because, you know, I'm thinking if this was a Hollywood movie, like that would be the scene, right?
Yeah,
you exactly. Need to have that, right?
Here we're just avoiding the cliche, right?
Right, exactly. It's going out of its way, and it's even making it more painful in a certain sense, because like, I don't even get to have the catharsis of a Hollywood movie scene in my own life, right? So I think that that's part of why the French New Wave is so important, because it gave license to do these kinds of things in other movies, right? And it gives, I think, a resonance to these films that you would lose if you kept having the cliches or the big dramatic death scene, right? Because it's requiring you to just focus in on the film, or rather on the characters, right, and the story that they're telling you today versus the dramatic moment from the past. So just a little side there. But going to your question just about the filmmaking, it is very well shot, but I think the real key to me in this was the editing. So it's a team of editors, Henri Colpi, Jasmine Chasny, and Anne Sarouet. Or Saruete, not sure how the name's pronounced there, but those three obviously had a massive job to figure out how to assemble this.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's a film that really could be very painful to watch if it wasn't edited correctly. I mean, it could be just, I think the beginning is less successful than the later parts of the film, because it does feel a little tedious with the narration.
It's just too long. Yeah, it just, cut out about 5 minutes of that, and you'd be good.
Right. I mean, and you could maybe then add in a little bit more with the characters you're getting it later. Because it's a short film. It's only 90 minutes. Mm-hmm. But I just think that the way, especially the imagery of the new Hiroshima is juxtaposed with their own personal stories, the way they cut between Nevers and Hiroshima really hits home visually the idea of the universality of these experiences that are being recounted, right? And so I think those things are masterfully done. And what's interesting to me is that obviously we talked earlier about just that intense close-up of the bodies embracing each other, but so much of the film is close-up, actually. You could easily make, they do have some, you know, some scenes to show different parts of the city and get the sense of the scale of the blast and its aftermath. But there's very little of that. It's actually a lot of it's close. And I mean, to the point that they did shoot on location, but you could have shot a lot of this on a studio, right?
I think a lot of it was, but yeah.
Oh, I'm sure. I mean, it's a mixture of things, right? But it's just that you do get, like, even the scenes where they're in the square where the bomb would have been detonated, right? It's still mostly close up. And it's an interesting choice because it creates an intimacy that I think would not have been achieved if you had the standard coverage of wide shot, going for a medium shot, maybe an accent with a close up, go back to a medium shot. It just seems like there's a lot that's happening through the shot choices as well in terms of creating the impression of the film.
Yeah, and I kind of alluded to this earlier, but this certainly is a Cold War protest film, I think, on many levels, or at least a nuclear protest film.
Well, it literally has us watch signs go by for exactly. Like 2 or 3 minutes.
It's not subtle. Like, yeah, there's literally a protest march that's within the film, right? In this picture, but yeah, it's not subtle with some of those messages, and certainly including some of the most graphic, you know, post A-bomb footage in the beginning of the film in particular, also is meant to be a cautionary note in this film. So I think that's important to include here. You know, I mean, if you're setting it in Hiroshima or Hiroshima, depending on your pronunciation, it's something that you just can't ignore, right? And I, you know, we kind of talked about the morality of relationships versus the morality of war, and whether or not setting a relationship like this in this kind of a setting is appropriate, you know. And I think, again, there's some thematic connections there that we made. Do you ever feel like it's exploitative at any point?
No, but I also wonder if that's because the images, you know, being in black and white don't have the same effect of watching in color. Mm-hmm. You know, I was thinking about that watching this time, not so much whether it was exploitative, but just that for a lot of audiences, this would have been the first time they probably ever saw
the actual images, effects, yeah,
you know, of what it was. And so you go, is there a value for a film that's supposed to tell you, hey, we're going to want to examine the effect and the aftermath of this war? Can you do that without having people get a sense of it?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that you could. So I don't think it's gratuitous at the very least. And so I guess because it's not gratuitous, I guess I wouldn't think it exploitative.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the performances I do think are pretty outstanding in this film. I mean, they have to be carried. The visuals are very important and central here, of course. But when it's a film primarily just about two people walking and talking, the performances better be strong to carry that. And they deliver here. I mean, Manuel Riva and Eiji Okada are both great, you know. And you can really see how this film would have had a big influence on other pictures of the time, but even films today, I mean, it's impossible not to think of something like In the Mood for Love in comparison to this film, even something like Before Sunrise. You know, any film that just involves a chance meeting of two lovers having deep, meaningful conversations, I think can be traced back to this film in some capacity. So probably not the first film to do it, but most certainly not the last.
One, I think maybe rare is the movie that gets noticed, the first one, but it's certainly the one that seemed to make the mark, right?
Yeah.
I would just like to point out for Eiji Okada's performance, the fact that he didn't speak French. So they had translators on the set. He was given the dialogue phonetically, and then they could record it afterwards mm-hmm. in terms of the actual directing of the way in which he spoke, you know. But it's just, it is really impressive that you never get the, I mean, you get obviously the sense that English wouldn't be his first language, or excuse me, the French wouldn't be his first language. But the fact that he comes across so convincingly in the French, it's really good. I mean, I was thinking about Gong Li's performance in Miami Vice and how unconvincing she is, having done the same thing with the phonetic English to try to get the language and everything. And I just really was impressed by that, because I would never guess that he didn't know French. I would have thought that would have been something that they just find us a Japanese actor that can speak good enough French to make a movie, right?
Yeah.
The fact that his French obviously might not be as perfect, you know, is great, because that would be true probably of the man himself. You know, if there was this Japanese architect that learned French at some point, it probably would be obviously a second language, right? Mm-hmm. So I thought it worked really well, and the chemistry between the two of them is quite believable. I mean, these kinds of affairs, I assume, are usually purely physical, and then it's done. But you are believing that because of their past and what they're going through, that somehow they would open up a little bit this way. And I love the scene where she tells them, you know, about the story, and his reaction is nobody else knows, is this little smile and this little sense of, wow, you have revealed something to me. And the sense of how he connects to her because of that, I think, is really nicely handled in the performances.
Yeah, it's a nice moment. I mean, it's what he's looking for, right? He's looking for a sign of a deeper connection. And
her too. Because I think, doesn't she say something like, it's good to be with somebody or something? I can't remember. You get the sense that she could not tell her husband about this because of what that would mean back in France.
Yeah, she just says, like, it's so nice to be with someone. Something simple like that. But you know that she's kind of going for a deeper connection when it comes to what she's saying there. Well, we can talk about Criterion's release here briefly. So, as I mentioned before, it's a new digital restoration, 4K, only available on regular DVD at the moment.
It's on Blu-ray.
Oh, I'm sorry. On regular Blu-ray is what I meant to say, not 4K.
Okay.
it does have an audio commentary with Peter Cowie, some interviews with Alain René and Emmanuel Riba, both archival, and then for Riba, there's a 2003 interview. As I recall, this was released on DVD initially, and then the re-release with the Blu-ray, and they changed the cover art, I think. So other extras include a new interview with film scholar Francois Thomas and music scholar Tim Page, a program about the film's restoration. So a nice release. I've got the Blu-ray. could not speak to the extras. Did not get a chance to review them, but they sure sound good. How about you, Nate?
Well, I did do my due diligence so that at least one of us could talk about the extras.
This is the running joke.
One of these times, I'm not going to do it and be like, Matt, it's all on you. You have to watch them. I'm going to refuse. I will not watch one supplement.
There's no obligation to go through all the supplements.
But no, they are good. Peter Cowie, always, I like his commentaries. You know, he's just really thoughtful. Obviously,
so
prepares himself. So,
yep.
Really good. And it's interesting. He talked about how he didn't like it when he first saw it, and really came around to like it. And that he could tell, even though he didn't like it, that it made an impression upon him. So he would seek it out regularly back in the 1960s, at a time when, of course, you didn't have home video, right? So it would have been obviously quite a strong will of his to go hunt down this movie that he didn't seem to like. But no, they're all well done. It's actually really a well stacked disc in terms of the supplements. Before we go into our final question, I just thought we could maybe talk about the score. We didn't talk about it earlier.
Oh, the score?
Yeah.
I just mentioned it that I thought it was effective, but if you want to expand on it, go ahead.
Well, I would say the reason why I think it is effective, I think why the score is so effective, is that it's so unconnected to the actual images, right? I mean, it's not like it's stinging things. It doesn't feel like, okay, now this is a romantic scene, therefore here's a romantic piece. It all seems to be so uninterested almost in commenting on and directing your experience of the imagery, that's why I think it's so effective, because it's striking a little differently than the typical kind of score you would book. I know it's a joint collaboration, right? De La Rue probably would have, if he had just done the whole thing, probably would have done that kind of scoring.
Yeah, probably.
And very lyrical, right? But Giovanni Fusco is the one that did most of the scoring, and it is just an interesting juxtaposition to the imagery.
Yeah, it works very well, especially during those flashback sequences, and really sells the film as a meditation on memory, just as much as it is an examination of kind of the aftermath of war and relationships in general. So, it works very well. So, Nate, Hiroshima Mon Amour, does it belong in the Criterion Collection?
I would say yes. Renee, I think, had a big influence on people. It's probably next to Night and Fog, his most famous work. Certainly probably his most famous narrative work. So I think yes.
I would agree. I probably mispronounced Hiroshima too many times in this, so forgive me. What is the accurate way of saying it? I guess it's whether or not you do the Japanese pronunciation or not.
Well, I don't actually know what's considered the Japanese versus the American. I've been told...
I think it's Hiroshima.
I grew up with Hiroshima.
Yeah.
And then I started hearing people go, Hiroshima.
Yeah.
And then I was told, no, that was just Americans thinking they're being really cultured. It's actually probably Hiroshima. And I was just like, I really don't know. I'm just going to say Hiroshima.
Okay, well... Any Japanese listeners, if I've offended you, I apologize.
Leave a comment. You know, leave a review, comment, tell the world how we got it wrong or right, or
don't invite, explain to us. Don't invite one-star reviews. Well, back to the film. It's a very important film. You know, on that basis alone, I think it should be included. But I also think it's a very strong film. I do enjoy this picture. I think it's very effective for what it's trying to do. And if you like this kind of filmmaking, you know, if you like flashbacks and cutaways, nonlinear editing, Terrence Malick, things of that nature, this is an important film to visit, because in many ways this is where a lot of that began. So definitely also a film I think worth revisiting in our current geopolitical climate, right? So the idea of nuclear war is something that's very abstract to us these days. You know, revisiting a film like this might be helpful for realigning our sense of what's possible and what kind of conflict that we want to avoid. Well, thanks everyone for listening this evening. Our film next month will be Purple Noon, which will be released in May. Thanks again, and keep collecting.